Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, I want to tell you a little bit about our sponsors this week. First up is Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a website. If you have some idea you've been waiting to get off the ground, a business or a portfolio, anything you need a website for, there is not an easier, more beautiful way to do it than Squarespace. If you go right now to squarespace.com/longform, you'll get 10% off with your first purchase, but you don't need to buy anything. You can try it all out. Go check it out. squarespace.com/longform. Another thing for you to check out if you just want to do some reading, HP Matter, the new issue is out. It's on the idea economy. There are all kinds of fascinating articles about the future of business, all the ideas that are going to power our business future, including an essay by the CEO of HP, Meg Whitman. Go check that out, hpmatter.com. Thanks very much to them for sponsoring the show. And here is that show. Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm here with Aaron Lammer of Longform and Evan Ratliff of Atavist. You guys, it's good to see you. How are you?
Hey, doing well. I injured myself in a cooking accident.
Wow.
I have my thumbs taped up.
It does look like you received fine medical care.
Is that a pro job? That looks like that tape that you use for when you're painting and you need to pull it off.
Yeah, it does a trick.
Send your well wishes to Evan Ratliff.
R.I.P. the end of Evan's thumb.
I wonder how many times I need to say our address on this podcast before someone spontaneously shows up here.
I would say it's a sign that no one's shown up yet.
But Max, you took a journey away from the office.
I did. I left 68 J Street and I went to Portland, Oregon. And among the things I did there was spend a couple of hours in Cheryl Strayed's living room talking to her about her memoir, Wild, and the advice column she wrote for The Rumpus called Dear Sugar, and also just about living life. Can I say that? That's kind of what we talked about, was life.
Hey, live your life.
There's definitely a question in here in which I said, fear, how do you deal with that?
That, I feel like
an answer we could all use.
You could just recycle that for almost every podcast.
It's definitely true that like I want to ask it every time, but she's actually written quite eloquently about that. But we talked about that. We talked about going on vacation with Oprah.
Yeah.
We talked about having Reese Witherspoon play you in a movie. We talked about having all of this happen after you were dead broke, and it was great, man. It was a there's not a better way to spend a Monday afternoon than several hours in Cheryl Strayed's living room.
I think it's worth saying to the listeners that we have a very long list of people that we want to get on the podcast. When people suggest people, we add them to that list. And Cheryl Strayed has been
on
list.
The back of a receipt.
It's true, though. We made that list almost 3 years ago when we started the show, and Cheryl Strayed was on my list then, and I have now crossed her off.
Our sponsor this week, as always, is Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. There's no simpler, more elegant way to get an email newsletter off the ground. Thank you, Tiny Letter.
Now here's Max with Cheryl Strayed.
Did you have like a rule if someone brought it to you directly? Like if someone said like, Cheryl, are you Dear Sugar? Would you say yes?
Yes. I tried not to tell people, but if they asked me directly, yeah, I would say yes. I also got emails.
But you wouldn't
emails
like drop hints and be like, man, I really thought the last Dear Sugar was amazing.
Well, the hardest thing. So I had just written the column, How You Get Unstuck, which is one of the most sort of famous Dear Sugar columns. It's a letter from a woman who'd had a miscarriage and was really stuck in her grief and her anger. And I wrote this Sugar column where I told the story of these girls I worked with on the east side of Portland, these teenage girls who I was their sort of like pregnancy prevention youth advocate counselor. And that column, I actually wrote it in the middle of the night. I many of those Sugar columns, because I was always up against it, I was paid nothing for those columns. So I never could prioritize that. I was doing so many things and I had two little toddlers. And I wrote that column, like any number of those columns in the middle, you know, stayed up all night writing it. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was at the Sewanee Writers Conference. I had just arrived and stayed up all night in my dorm, wrote the column, sent it to Isaac Fitzgerald, who was at the Rumpus at the time. And it went, you know, on the website like a few hours later. And so by that evening, I was at a cocktail party. And the writers, Aaron Kyle and Nina McConnigley, were standing around talking about the latest Dear Sugar column. And they said to me, have you read this latest Jigger column. It's, you know, you have to read it. It's so great. And it almost killed me because right. I'm like standing here with these two writers I adore and respect. And they're at a writerly cocktail party talking about something I've written. And there was this huge dilemma, you know, what do I do? And so I remained silent for a while. And then finally, at one point, I just looked at Aaron, Kyle, and I just said, I wrote that column. Don't tell anyone. And she was like, oh my God. And she and Nina, you know, they kept my secret. They kept my secret. So
didn't have any regrets in that moment though?
Well, I was always conflicted because then I had that was sort of the first of those experiences where I was in the world and somebody was talking to me about something I'd written and they didn't know I'd written it, which is a very strange experience.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I would break down and tell them, and sometimes I would remain silent. And in both cases, I felt unsure if I'd done the right thing. Because of course, when you have a secret, you want to keep the secret. It's also fun to divulge the secret.
Right.
And it's fun to have a secret with other people. So certainly there were many people in the lit world who knew that I was Sugar before I revealed my identity, because there was that kind of, you know, inner circle knew about it.
Right.
Were you reading the column when I was publishing it on The Rumpus?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you know it was me? Did you know who I
No.
was? So when I revealed, you were like, okay, who is this Cheryl Strait?
Yeah, that was like the, like many people, I just Googled Cheryl Strait.
Right.
That was like the first thing I did. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know. And like, well, what was the impetus for revealing it?
Well, from the very beginning, I knew I would reveal my identity. I mean, that's always some of the most interesting experiences, maybe all of them, you know, they become more interesting in retrospect, in hindsight. You know everything that happened and how it came to be. And so often things seem more planned than they actually were. You know, when I first took over the column from Steve Almond, from the very beginning, there was this discussion, should I be anonymous? He had been, but he had also not been himself in the column. He was anonymous and trying to...
Right, and a character.
You know, be a character. And I knew that I was going to be a persona on the page, but I was essentially going to be me. And sort of the meanness of it evolved over time. Like the first few columns, I think I was trying to be a little more funny and, you know, calling people sweet pea and being sort of sassy. But that sort of fell away with time. And it really was just me writing essays about life and about my life and my friends' lives and addressing people's problems. But from the beginning, I knew that this would be this anonymity thing would just be a piece of it for me. And that eventually I would say that I'd written the columns. And so every column I wrote it as if my name were attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
I never wrote anything that I couldn't stand behind as Cheryl. And what that meant is there are all these stories that went untold. You know, I think one of the biggest misperceptions of a writer like me who has written so deeply about my own life and often about things that have been difficult or seem very personal, I think that people think that that means I've told them everything. You know, there are many parts of my life that I haven't written about for reasons that have to do with protecting other people's privacy, for not wanting to hurt other people's feelings. I mean, I think that the interesting part of anonymity, if I'd been truly anonymous and sworn to that and stayed anonymous all my life, there are so many different stories I could have told that I didn't.
I have so many questions. You just touched on like all these things I want to talk to you about. I'm very interested in like the sort of pragmatic writing of an advice column and how you did that and whether those answers just came to you or whether you would sort of like think about them and mull them over for a while. But you said something else that I want to talk about for a second, which is people feeling like they know you and people feeling connected to you. And we're in Portland where you ended this book of yours, Wild. And right now there are something like 10, I read this morning, 10 times the number of people who are about to go hike the PCT this summer, all of whom, or many of whom, feel connected to you, deeply connected to you through that book. How does it feel to have people trying to recreate your story, knowing that they don't actually know necessarily the whole story?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I hope that they're doing, and I think in most cases what they're doing, is they're not really trying to recreate my story. They're trying to live theirs, and mine has inspired them in some way, made them brave in some way, opened them up to themselves in some way. That's what I hear from most people who write to me, mm-hmm. Some of them are people who are going and hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. Most of them are people who are doing something else. Sometimes that's a wilderness adventure. Sometimes it's quitting their job or deciding to end a relationship that isn't good for them anymore, or any number of things, or just even in a more daily way, being braver or kinder or any number of things. One of the most interesting things that, in Dear Sugar, I was giving people advice, and in Wild, I wasn't, but both are sort of read in that way.
Yeah.
They sort of blur together in terms of the effect that they have on people and the things that people say.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, they're very different books. One's a collection of advice letters and columns, and one is, a memoir that's much more introspective in nature than the advice columns. But in both, I'm really trying to dig beneath the surface of the sort of everyday, and especially in the emotional realm, to really look at, what have been my struggles? Where have I failed? Where have I risen? How did I dig my way out of the hole that I dug myself into? How did I contend with the bad things that happened to me that I didn't have any control over? What was ultimately my answer to them? And so, I think in both, with Wild, when you ask me about these people who are going to recreate my story, it would be impossible for them to do that. We can only live our own lives. I really hope, that I've only been an inspiration, that nobody's trying to replicate what I did, because you can't, of course. We all are on our own journeys, and I use that word journeys. It can sound so woo-woo, but I do think that life is a journey, and good things and bad things happen to us. And some of those things, sometimes we need to kind of step back and reflect upon them. And on my hike, that's what I was doing. So I think it's a wonderful thing that people are inspired to do that in their own lives after reading Wild.
All right, let's go back to Dear Sugar. Let's talk about the how you actually did the process of writing that column.
Right.
So you get all these letters. I assume do they like come to your house?
Yeah. Well, they're okay. So let's just back up. So First of all, Wild and Tiny Beautiful Things, which is the collection of my Dear Sugar letters. Those books were written sort of on top of each other. I always say Tiny Beautiful Things is like the book I wrote by accident, because what happened is I wrote Wild. Wrote the first draft, almost killed me the way it does to write a book, sent it off to my editor, and I was waiting to hear from her notes. There's that little lull where you have nothing to do. You've just done this huge thing, and then you've got nothing to do. And this is when I took on the Dear Sugar gig, and I began writing this column. And it was this little thing I thought I was going to do on the side.
But you'd been doing all that work. Like, you had just gone and processed that whole period in your life.
Yes, and all of my life has been a processing. Mm-hmm. Even my first book, Torch, which is a novel, it's an incredibly emotional novel, and it too demanded a lot from me in that regard, having to forgive people and cry and understand mortality and love and, all of these things, right? You have to do this, I think, to write a book. And so I was primed. But so when I was asked to do Dear Sugar, I thought, well, this will be a lark. This will be a fun thing. This will finally be something where I don't have to be so, heavy. Right. And so I was going to be like as funny as Steve Almond, and I took it over. And there, what happened is it's kind of like the advice I give Dear Sugar, like everywhere you turn, there you still are, right? We can't essentially escape who it is that we are. And I, for better or worse, I'm a writer who likes to go into that subterranean emotional world and to talk about the mysterious and dark and beautiful places inside of us. Mm-hmm. And so with the Dear Sugar column, I found myself doing that. I always felt that story was the greatest consolation to me in my sorrow. And so when I started to try to help people in their sorrows and their confusions, I had to tell stories. I think, sometimes we think, okay, wait, Sugar is like talking about herself again. Here she is in this column. She was supposed to be helping him deal with this, and she's telling this story from her childhood. But what my intention was always, I'm going to use this story to help you, mm-hmm. And that's where at least where I tried to always have those columns land, where I might have told a story about myself, but it was really about the letter writer. It was really about how can that story illuminate a truth that is universal, not just for me, not just for the letter writer, but for the listeners. I mean, that column was like doing therapy in the town square.
Yeah. Did that come naturally to you? Had you always been kind of wired that way?
It did come naturally, but that doesn't mean it wasn't a huge surprise to me. Because when I first was offered the gig, I was like, oh, this is probably a bad idea, you know.
How come?
Because it didn't pay anything.
Right. For one.
I was absolutely broke. Really struggling. I mean, seriously, epically struggling financially. Had two little kids. My husband's a documentary filmmaker. I mean, there were real reasons not to do that. Because, of course, you know, that's time spent on something that I, you know, wasn't making money for. And I already was. Like, I was interested in writing my books, which was also unpaid work, right? So, you know, there's only so much unpaid work you can do. And so it was a bad idea. And yet, I sort of trusted my gut that I have to do this. But what happened is all those friends who I consulted, like, do you think I should do this? And they were like, oh, maybe not. They all were reading the column and said, Cheryl, you really found your voice here in this form. And it was a surprise to me. I wasn't a fan of advice columns. I'd never read any number of advice columns before I began writing my own. I think it was this experience where I got to use everything I knew as a fiction writer and memoirist and then use it in this incredibly direct address. The direct address of a letter just has an inherent power. You know, I am speaking directly to you. Like right now, if you told me your problem and I tried to help you with it.
That's my secret plan for this interview, by the way.
There would be an intensity and intimacy that all the listeners could hear that would be different than if you said, you know, my friend has this problem.
Right.
You know, there is something about talking directly to somebody who was suffering that allowed me to be, I think, more fearless than I'd ever been.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that because that column read to me like just written from such a place of confidence and kind of like wisdom and knowledge, and they almost felt fully formed. Like that was one of the things I was wondering about. It's like, you know, I'd read the letter and I'd be like, man, I have no fucking clue what I would say to that person. And then you would come out with this answer and it'd be like, that is the exact right thing to say. Like, would you get that letter and like go on a long walk? Would you know immediately where you were going to land?
I would go on a long walk, yes, and think. I never knew where I would land. I've been a writer, a serious writer, since I was like 19 or 20. And I would say that the difference between being a writer now in my 40s versus being a writer in my 20s is that I have just learned how to trust the mystery of the writing process. And I think that the most important thing that I've learned to trust is that I don't know where I'm going to land, and it's okay, but to follow the path, you know, where it leads me. If for some reason I keep thinking about this one experience I had, you know, going to a hippie retreat center with my kids and casting a hunk of bread into the fire, if I feel like I have to tell that anecdote about being with my kids on the winter solstice at a hippie retreat, and we're grabbing these hunks of bread and we're casting into the fire something that we need to let go of. Like, if for some reason I read a letter from somebody who's struggling with something and I need to tell that story, what I do is I write it and I trust that there's something intuitive, there's some intuitive place within me that's sort of driving me forward as, you know, say, like, write that story and then see where that leads you next. And I would say about 90% of the time, it led me to a place that was really powerful and fertile. And then other times it's like, yeah, for some reason I want to write this story in relation to this letter and I can't land it. I can't figure out how to build that bridge between the two, you know, scenarios. Do you know what I'm talking about? How so often in the sugar letters, it would be like, here's the problem. And then I would start with some like story that seemed completely not yeah. connected at all. You know, what is like the woman with the miscarriage? What are the three girls I, you know, that I wrote about? You know, what do those people have in common?
As a reader, I'm sort of like trusting your instincts the same way you're trusting your instincts.
Right.
I mean, what I'm hearing you say is, I knew the fact that I was gravitating towards that story meant there was something there.
Yeah.
And there was a bridge would form even if I didn't know exactly what it was.
Yeah.
That's how you read those columns too, is you're like, I don't understand how this story is possibly going to connect to this question, but I'll stick with it. And
right.
then they always landed. Like that's,
thank you.
They land. And I wonder whether like was that part of who you'd always been, or did that, was that something that just started when you started to do that column and you found that voice and you found like we were able to trust in those connections? Like, were you someone that your friends went to for advice?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, but it's interesting. I don't give advice in that way, mostly because we don't allow each other to give advice in that way.
Mm-hmm.
If a friend asked me for advice and I sat there and started to tell, you know, some story that seems completely unrelated, she would just be like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, like I'm talking about my husband or whatever, you know. But I think that trusting intuition in the writing process is something that absolutely is present in both my life and my writing in its other forms. But I will say in the sugar column, it's more pronounced, you know, and it is because in the difference between giving advice and writing a short story is that you actually are trying to be explicit and direct in ways that you're trying to be discreet and subtle in other ways. And the other thing, though, I want to just say about intuition and like, oh my gosh, I don't know how this is going to land, is that so you trust the intuition, but then there is this point in the writing process where you damn well better know what you're doing. You damn well better know the connection, that the intuition falls away, you trust the intuition to get to that place you need to go as a writer. But then it's not all just like, you know, I don't know how it's connected, I just know it is. This kind of, it sounds poetic and so it must mean something. Like, that never has worked for me. I've always had to eventually say, no, this is the bridge. You know, the bridge between this letter writer's problem and this story I just told is right there.
What does that look like in a practical sense? Like, what is doing that work mean?
Well, it's things like, so for example, this letter, How You Get Unstuck. Like I said, the letter writer wrote about having a miscarriage, how grief-stricken she was about this, how she blamed herself. She was angry at the people around her who didn't sympathize. And I tell this story about working as a youth advocate with these girls who had, you know, incredibly difficult lives. Their fathers were in prison. Many of them had been victims of sexual abuse. Their mothers were often drug addicts or mentally ill. They had hard lives. And I wrote about the ways that I tried to help them, and the ways that I finally had to accept that, like, there was only so much I could do for them. Mm-hmm. That really the only way, what I figured out is, when I was a youth advocate, is, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to help people who need help, okay? But ultimately, the truth is that we have to help ourselves. You know, we all benefit from people helping us, but we will never get anywhere if we don't help ourselves. And so what I offered this letter writer who was suffering was this thing I'd learned in working with the girls, which is healing is entirely and absolutely up to you. And so here you are, you're suffering and you're suffering legitimately. And now how are you going to change your life? Because nobody's going to do it for you. And that's what I witnessed those girls doing, the ones who did go on and not replicate mm-hmm. the lives of their mothers. And so, you know, so there are these two stories. There's the story of the girls and there's the story of the woman who had a miscarriage. But the truth that runs like a river beneath it is the universal truth that we all are responsible for our lives. We will all suffer and we all need to find light in that darkness, strength in that weakness, you know? And so
was that something that even at that point in your life, you were still working on and like trying to internalize yourself?
Always. That's the funniest thing. And that the most uncomfortable thing I think about being sugar is like, it's never, and I'm always saying this in the column and whenever I can talk about it, is like, it's not as if I'm some sort of font of wisdom and perfection. What I'm speaking to is like my own struggle. Like I'm talking to myself too, all the time, every day. It's not as if I have the answer and I'm sort of, I'm giving the answers. I'm instead really down there in the struggle, speaking to it, trying mm-hmm. to speak as openly as possible about what it means to be human. But, you know, it is funny that I'm always having to kind of answer this because I think that advice columnists have been framed in this really weird way in our culture. Like as if, you know, as if Dear Abby really was an expert. She wasn't. Dear Abby was a person. And in all of her humanity, I'm sure she was flawed and she struggled and she had secrets and she did bad things and she did good things. And she was not the boss of anyone. We just decided that she could be.
Don't you think part of that, though, is like that the advice columnist never just says, I don't know?
Well, we wouldn't go to the advice column if they just said, I don't know. I mean, in some, what I was first going to say is in so many ways, I often did say, I don't know. Like, I don't know if you should stay married to your spouse or not.
Right.
I don't know if you should invite your father to your wedding or not. But here are some things to think about when you're pondering that situation. And that's what I was always trying to do as Sugar. There are some things, you know, I do know. Striving for forgiveness always makes your life better. Trying to be generous always makes your life better. Trying to be kind, trying to live your life with love in your heart, which sounds so hokey, it makes your life better. Staying in a relationship with somebody who's abusing you is never a good idea. So there are those truths, but usually our lives are much messier. So usually I wasn't saying do this or don't do that. I was sort of trying to expand the question.
Quick word from our sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace is the best way to build a website. You probably have an idea for a website right now. It is a good idea. It's a better idea than you think. If you have some doubt, if you're not sure, I'm telling you to go for it. That idea is good. Maybe it's your personal website. Maybe it's a portfolio for your work. Maybe it's a business you've wanted to start. Maybe you own a business already and you just haven't gotten around to building a website. Either way, no matter what it is, go ahead. Build that website, and you should do it with Squarespace. Squarespace is super, super easy. They've got these beautiful templates. You don't need to know a lick of code. Everything is just plug and play. It just works, and it works anywhere, any device, your phone, your tablet, your desktop. Your site's going to look great no matter what. Plus, if you go to squarespace.com/longform, that's squarespace.com/longform. If you use the code longform at checkout, you'll get 10% off when you pay. Plus, you'll get a free domain. But here's the thing. You don't even need all that. Just go to squarespace.com and try it out for free. Start building your website. See how easy it is to use. You will not find a better, more simple, more elegant way to finally build that website that you've been meaning to build. I promise you, you will feel better when it's done. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. Also sponsoring the show this week is HP Matter. HP Matter is a magazine put out by HP and Fast Company. Their new issue just hit the internets. It's the idea economy, all kinds of articles and charts and graphics and videos about the ideas that are going to power our future in business. There really is tons of fantastic stuff. We're featuring a bunch of it on Longform this week. So you can go to longform.org and find those. You can go to hpmatter.com and find those. But go check it out. It's a way to support this show, and we really thank them for supporting this show. But for now, let's get back to Cheryl Strayed.
You said a couple of times in this interview, like you just said, it sounds hokey. And earlier you said, like, this sounds like woo-woo.
Right.
Like you said, how do you get over that? Like, how do you get over, like, this, the, like, mushy, sappy part of this?
I know. I'm like the accidental self-help writer because I don't even, you know, I don't even read self-help books. Like, it was the funniest thing to me when Tiny Beautiful Things came out and I was in a bookstore and there was my book in the self-help section. Yeah. And I was like, wait a minute. This isn't self-help. And then I'm thinking, well, of course it is. Like, what the hell else is it, right? It's advice. When I say that, what I'm trying to, I guess, protect myself from or defend myself against is this intellectually mushy body of work that is in that genre. And I'm not saying, I mean, I think there are probably some great self-help books. I'm not saying that, like, one shouldn't read self-help books. I know that they've been incredibly helpful to so many people. I want to say that first. But I think a lot of them in that category do tend to be a little bit intellectually soft. They're not necessarily as rigorous as maybe I tend to try to be in my life when it comes to talking about my problems, solving my problems, and, you know, that kind of struggle. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
Like the answers, like you were just talking about the subterranean depths that you like to go to.
Yeah.
And I think what you're maybe saying is, like, sometimes those self-help books don't actually get to that level. Like, it doesn't actually get to a very uncomfortable place. It just kind of tells you what you want to hear.
Right. And they tend to be a little more black and white and not as complicated as I am interested in being. I think, too, that it's really important to recognize, you know, class and privilege and, you know, race and like all of those things that self-help can kind of erase. Like this idea of like, you know, if you decide that you want to be a millionaire, you just, you know, think about it every day
with
and put it on
five
a poster.
Easy steps,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, exactly. Five easy steps to be fill in the blank. And I don't believe that, you know, I think that all kinds of good things can happen because you think positively. And yet I think that there are limits to that as well. Sometimes real life happens. One of the worst things in my life was when my mom got sick with cancer. So many people said, well, she just has to think positive about this. And my mom was 45 and she had a terminal diagnosis. She died 7 weeks to the day after she was diagnosed. And she wanted to live and she didn't. And she didn't have any power over that. And so for a long time, I was really angry, I guess, at that sort of very prevalent idea that we could conquer these terminal diseases with positive thinking. Mm-hmm. Because the fact of the matter is sometimes people just get sick and die. And sometimes you just have to live with that fact, no matter what you want.
No doctor would ever say sometimes you just get sick and die.
Right. But sometimes you do. Why do you think no doctor would say that?
Because there's no upside, I guess, right? There's risk in saying it and there's no risk in not saying it.
Mm-hmm.
People want to believe that it's true.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, what's been really complicated for me to express about, you know, when I give advice to people, so much of it is things like you have to be a positive thinker. You know, you really do have to control your mind in some way and think I can instead of I can't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the danger in saying that is always like, will that be misinterpreted where it's taken to its extreme, you know, that you say, well, you know, that you can actually, you know, reverse course on things like a terminal diagnosis, you know, with positive thinking.
Right.
So to me, what I would, if I had to say like in one fell swoop, like what is sugar? What is sugar trying to espouse? It's that two things can be true at once, even opposing truths. You know, it can be true that you will suffer forever because you were sexually abused as a child. It can also be true that you can overcome that and not let that experience define your life. Mm-hmm. And you can hold those two truths in two hands and walk forward. And I think that same thing, like with the positive thinking, you can't necessarily, you know, think your way out of lung cancer, but you can have a happier life if you think positively in the face of profound sorrow.
Right. Right. The end can be better.
Yeah.
I mean, that is one of the kind of major themes of sugar is like, do the work, move forward, like take the first step.
Yeah.
It is like focusing on what you do control and what is in your power and not generally not like feeling sorry for yourself.
Yeah.
Does that sound right to you?
It does. It sounds familiar. And you know, one of the things, this is the first time I'm saying this to anyone. This is hot off the presses news. You're getting a breaking story here on the Long Form podcast. I have a book coming out in like the end of November, early December, and it's called Brave Enough. And it's a book of quotes culled from, you know, Dear Sugar. And so my Tiny Beautiful Things book, Wild Torch, my essays and my talks and so forth. And it was really just sort of born out of, it was my publisher's idea because so many people have taken quotes and put them like on posters and put them on Pinterest,
like a motherfucker
mug. You know, all the mugs, t-shirts, all this stuff, tattoos, quilts, whatever. And there's so many of these quotes floating around that my publisher was like, well, why not put a book together? So I put these books of my quotes together and it was really fascinating to see, you know, like what have I been saying all these years? And what you just said, it kind of, I should have had you just do the book.
it's like the world according to Cheryl Strayed.
That's right. That's what we should have called the book.
The bite-sized wisdom of Cheryl Strayed.
That's right.
Does it feel like, I know I'm like, maybe I'm asking the same question over and over again. I just feel like, do you feel like you have it all figured
out? Does it feel weird? No, of
like,
course I don't.
If you put out a book that's like, here's a bunch of things that are like universal truths that millions of people have responded to in very positive ways, do you not on some level just be like,
no,
like, hell yeah. Like,
no.
I got it.
The opposite. And it really, I mean that sincerely. I mean, it really is the opposite of that. I feel like all of those quotes and you know, that people have, you know, saved for them, you know, repeated on Twitter or whatever it is. Like, those really are conversations I have with myself. Life is a daily struggle. You wouldn't believe how fucked up my life is. I mean, you really, it actually, I have no sense at all that, like, that I have the answers. But what I do have a sense of is that I am somebody who has always sought the answers. Like, I'm a seeker. I've always asked questions. I've always wanted to know why people did things, or and kind of essential things. Like, when I was a little kid, my mom, when her friends would come over, my mom would say, now you can only ask them, you know, three questions, because I would just sit there and grill them.
Yeah.
You know, if it were a couple, I'd be like, well, why do you love her? Why do you really love her? You know, and I was like eight and people can't even like, why do you love your partner? I mean, you know, that's a deep question.
Yeah.
Like, why do you really love the people you love the most? And, you know, so I seek those answers. And I think that so much of that kind of advice stuff, or those quotes from Wild that people, you know, tattoo on them or whatever they do, put on mugs or whatever they do, it's about they also recognize their sense of seeking in themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they take those things I've written up as anthems, but it's not about me. It's totally about their life and their truth. And they're, you know, when you ask me, like, people replicating my journey, they're not replicating mine. They're talking about their own lives. And so I think that that's, you know, the kind of the original power of art. When we see a painting that we love, we're not standing there thinking about the artist who made it. We're thinking about how that painting makes us feel. Like, what that reflects to us about our lives or the world. And so I love, you know, when art exceeds essentially its creator, which is the whole goal of art, I think, when it becomes not about the person who created it, but about the people who consume it. And I think that this is especially true in memoir, where you're writing about yourself. It's, you know, it has this horrible false reputation for being like the narcissistic form, which I think is pure bullshit. No good memoir is really about the writer, and yet it's deeply about the writer.
Well, let's talk more about that, because, like, you use the metaphor of a subterranean river.
That's right. Is there such a thing? Yes, there are. They have to be underground rivers.
Sure. Yeah. Whatever. This is like neither of our field of
We're
expertise.
We're not geologists or whatever those people are.
I'm going to say yes, there are underground rivers.
Of course there are.
On this metaphorical underground river, is the reason that Wild or Sugar is able to tap into those universal truths is because if you get to that deeper level, it kind of like applies to anyone's life if you can get there?
Yes. I mean, no question. The number one thing I learned about Wild by witnessing its life in the world, which is to say its life beyond me, is that this story is not about me. You know, people around the world say the same things to me about Wild.
What do they say?
Wherever they are, they say the same things. You know, they could be in Cincinnati or South Korea or India or Australia, and they are. They have been. They, you know, I've met people in so many places, and they talk to me about their lives. They talk to me. They say things. So here are the common things I hear. One is the way I wrote about my grief, the way I wrote about how I felt about losing my mom. So many people can't articulate the sorrow that they feel over losing someone. And so they say to me, I've never read anyone who wrote my truth the way you did. You know, my brother died, or my mother died, or my son died, or whatever it is. And they tell me about their losses, and they tell me that I spoke for them in Wild. Other times, it's more about the journey. It's about, you know, I went on this kind of trip, or I always wanted to, or I need to. They identify with this idea of leaving and traveling, whether it be hiking or going on another kind of trip. And this journey isn't running away, but going deeper into your own life. It's not an escape tale. It's going down to that subterranean river. So they talk about that. And the third thing is this, the kind of redemption narrative. Mm-hmm. I fucked up and I had to fix it. And I had to figure out how to fix it. That's what people tell me about. I did this, I did that. And they tell me what the bad things they did and how they made it better. And they see themselves in Wild. So Wild was like holding a mirror up to each of those things. And those are very, one thing that those three things sort of have in common is they pretty much don't change over all of time. Like if we go back to the ancients, those three narratives I just wrote about, they're there too. Mm-hmm. Okay. They're in like the first writing that we have, you know, it's about sorrow. It's about redemption. It's about journey. You know, that the hero's journey. And so I do think when I teach writing, I'm always like saying to my students, like, okay, you might think that you're writing about your divorce or your infertility or whatever it is. Remember the ancients, because nobody wants to read your book about, you know, your little tale. Nobody should read my book because I took an interesting hike and I loved my mom a lot and she died. I mean, that's just a very small, insignificant story, insignificant to anyone but me. And so my job as the writer was to make it about other people.
Were you conscious of it when it was happening that you were in that subterranean river?
Absolutely. That's the writer's work, is consciousness. It doesn't happen by accident that you learn how to use your life as material for art. I mean, this is what we talk about when we talk about having to really apprentice yourself to the craft of writing. You know, so many aspiring writers that make that kind of initial mistake, they'll say, oh my gosh, you know, I had this horrible thing happen to me or this really exciting trip, and so I'm going to write a book about it. And, you know, sometimes you get lucky and you somehow manage to do that. Like in a couple of years, you manage to go from having the horrible thing or the great adventure and like turning it into a pretty good book. But most of us have to work harder and longer and figure out like how to write, like how to write a story that isn't about just you. And this is true whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction. I mean, honestly, there's, you know, the line between those genres, and that one is, you know, you're writing about things that actually happened, and another, you're not obligated to that. But when it comes to the you know, what you're trying to do on the page, they're very similar. And so you have to do that kind of, again, that deep sea diving, that I always use this language that has to do with going down deeper. And once you do that, I mean, when you speak in the truest, most intimate voice about your life, you are speaking with a universal voice.
I'm interested in that exact thing. So you're out on the trail and these things are happening to you, and you know that you're going to write about this. You know, this will be a story, that this is a story of your life. You strike me as someone who has been telling stories about your life, your whole life. And I wonder if, in the nonfiction side, whether there is an urge in those moments to sort of create a better story, to look for opportunities to improve the story. Mm-hmm. Like that dance between sort of like creating your own story and letting your story unfold in its truth. And I wonder how you think about that. Like, are you basically like creating your own truth?
Right. You know, I didn't know I was going to write about my hike. I took my hike in 1995, and I didn't begin writing the book until 2008. And so I didn't have that experience where I was on the trail and I was like, wow, okay, this will make a good book, or, you know, I should do this because it'll be so good in the book.
You weren't thinking that way.
I wasn't thinking that way. And I think that really made for a different book than if I had an experience like, you know, a lot of my peers have had, where they get a book deal and then go do that thing.
Right.
And then they write about that thing. I don't think that that's inherently wrong. I myself would be very uncomfortable doing it because I would do just what you said.
Yeah.
I would get myself in so much more trouble because it would make a better story. That's not fabricating experience, but it's altering an experience to an extent.
Why do you think you waited so long to write about it?
Because I was obsessed with writing my first book, mm-hmm. Torch. When I was on the trail, I was thinking about writing all the time, and I was thinking about my book, but it wasn't Wild. I was thinking about Torch.
Right.
So I was 26. I finished hiking the trail 2 days before my 27th birthday. I went to Portland. I got a job waiting tables. So I was working full time and, you know, busy writing on the side, writing Torch. And that took several years. I ended up going to graduate school at Syracuse University so I could finish the book. You know, it was like, my God, I'm 30 and I still don't have this damn novel done. And so graduate school at Syracuse, they cover your tuition and give you a stipend. So for 3 years, I was essentially paid to be a writer for the first time in my life. And that's where I wrote Torch. By the time Torch came out in 2006, I had 2 children under the age of 2. And then I spent a couple of years being like, oh my God, you know, writing essays and promoting Torch and mothering these 2 little babies who are 18 months apart. And so in 2008 is when I thought, okay, what's next? You know, I was at a point where I could, my youngest child was 2 and I could start to really seriously sink back into a book. And I thought it would be a collection of essays because at that point I had published several essays and I thought it could be, I could sort of simply, you know, put out an easy book, like, yeah. Put them together. And I was like, you know, there's one essay missing, and this is the story of my hike. And so I started writing Wild, which I thought was going to be a 20 or 30 page essay. And what happened is I just started writing, and then I realized that I had a story.
Your kids are
able
to contend for themselves just a bit enough for you to start thinking about a book. And
yeah, that's probably overstating it, but maybe it was like I scratched together enough dough to hire a babysitter for a few hours a week.
Right. As the parent of an 8-month-old, I'm hoping that like I've got, you know,
that there's a future for you.
I've got like, yeah, you know, 14 months and then like everything's going to be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. You just wait.
No more work.
At 14 months, it's worse because they run around the house and they can grab everything. They can actually walk,
start breaking
and hold
stuff.
Things. And throw things, yeah.
Yeah, he's so ready to break things. Okay, so, and did you know that Wild was going to be the next thing?
Well, so I was starting to write this theoretical collection of essays, and I started writing this essay and realized that it was bigger than you know, 20 or 30 pages, and then it just grew and grew and grew. And yeah, then I realized, okay, this is a memoir. I'm going to write about my hike and about everything that led me to it. And so then I spent just like a couple of years writing it. I finished it, like I said, I sent off the first draft right when I was becoming Sugar. So this was February of 2010 when I sent the first draft to my editor at Knopf. And so along the way there, like I was maybe 130 pages into the book when I really worked hard on refining those first 130 pages and sold the book to Knopf, you know, before I was finished with it.
Right. So, and tell me about going back and like reliving that time in your life. Like how it's so detailed and it's so rich in the story. And I wonder how you, from like a practical standpoint, how you report something that happened, whatever that was, you know, 13 years
yeah,
before.
Yeah, at that point it was 13 years. It's challenging in ways that I think most people don't assume. I mean, for me, I remember how I felt a lot. I remember the emotions a lot. It was, for me, the biggest challenge was like, well, what did it look like when I was there? You know, what were the flowers in this spot? Or where was the, you know, what kind of trees? And so, you know, really writing a memoir, I think of any sort, but certainly of Wild, it was this combination of researching. So going back and finding out the name, what flowers were growing there, and then finding out their name. And then I kept a journal all through my 20s and into my 30s. So that was great. You know, when I was...
You don't keep one anymore?
I don't. The minute my kids were born, I stopped journaling.
Really?
Because I just don't have the time now. Also, I think that transfer from the days of yore, you know, the personal introspective life that I think not just I, but many of us used to have, where we would sit in cafes and write in our journals and so forth, that is now sitting in cafes and, you know, tweeting and Facebooking.
That's the other thing. I mean, just reading the book, it's hard for me to imagine that you could have had that experience today.
I know, you can't.
You
can't,
right?
It's so sad. No, it breaks my heart. Because really, I mean, right now we could log on and we could read hundreds of trail journals from people who are right now hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. And what that means is, you know, even if I'm sure there's not, you know, internet access all through the trail, but there are points, you know, all along the way. And it's really, you know, the internet, it doesn't allow us to be alone. It's a portal into into the world that we can't reach. And so the beauty of that is, you know, you and I can talk to each other on opposite sides of the world at any given moment. But you lose something in that too, because when I was out alone on the Pacific Crest Trail, I was actually alone.
Yeah.
I couldn't reach anyone unless they were standing before me and they couldn't reach me. And I was really, truly alone. And I would write in my journal. So when I was reading Wild, or when I was writing Wild, I would read my journal, and it was so helpful because I could say, you know, this is what I was thinking in this moment. And many of the conversations in Wild are obviously remembered, the way that memoirists say, you know, we just remember this is what right. we said to each other. And I just, that's a conceit of memoir, right? But some of them were, I met somebody, we talked, they walked away, I wrote down what we said to each other. So some of the more interesting lines of dialogue I was able to write because I had written it in my journal. Mm-hmm. One example is there's a scene where I go and I get off the trail and I'm walking along this logging road, and I come and I on this Jeep road, and I come upon these three guys, these miners who are about to blow up this mountain. And one of them, you know, lifts my pack and he says, you know, when I was in Korea, I never carried a pack that heavy, or maybe I did once. It was because I was being punished, you know? So like that sort of thing that wasn't remembered. That was like, I'd recorded it in my journal. So it was helpful.
Right. So much pride in the weight of that pack.
Exactly. But the other thing, and this is something I find myself explaining over and over again to people who don't write memoir, is that memory really is a muscle that we work. And the way it functions is that, like, most of us, when we remember something from a decade or more ago, our first response is like, I don't remember. That was so long ago. But when you actually start to think about it and engage with it, what happens is your memory opens up. And the best thing I can compare it to is really when you see an old friend from back in the day and you start talking about things you did together. And you go from this, like, no, I don't remember. Oh, yeah, I do remember that now that you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. And so all you need is that kind of prompt that allows you to reengage with that part of your brain where that information is stored. And so really, you know, working, like being a memoirist is about working that muscle and learning how to, you know, sort of re-enter previous versions of yourself.
Did you do that in a physical sense? Like, did you go back to the trail?
I didn't go back to the trail when I was writing the book, except a couple places in Oregon nearby. I didn't have money. You know, I think that I would have liked to have, you know, gone to Southern California and, like, you know, gone to that first place I started hiking. I just didn't, like, literally didn't have the money to do it. But I did go back to the place where I began the trail when we were making the movie, you know, years past. And there I am standing there with Reese Witherspoon, and the movie where she begins the hike is exactly where I began my hike. And those first steps on the trail, those were my first steps on the trail. What an emotional day that was to have not been back there all those years and to be standing there with, you know, a movie star pretending to be me and lugging this pack that's an exact replica of mine.
Let's talk about the movie and sort of everything that has come for you in the last couple of years. Like, that must be a completely surreal moment standing there at the beginning of the trail. What's it been like?
One of many surreal moments. I mean, it's been so surreal that there aren't really words for it. It's so interesting that all of this has happened. And I've really had this opportunity to enter worlds that I never had access to before. Like, I really got a front row seat in Hollywood going through the whole film experience because I was so involved with it from beginning to end. You know, and it ended, you know, that red carpet trail, you know, literally, yeah. You know, ended at the Oscars. And I just delighted in it. It was really, it made me laugh a lot to get to see things and do things and be in places that I never thought my writing would lead me.
Did you feel like a interloper, or when you were, you know, on the red carpet, were you like, fuck yeah, I'm here?
I think I was more like, fuck yeah, I'm here. And that doesn't mean I didn't feel like an interloper. I felt like somebody who was in that world, but not of it, you know? And I loved that I could just sit there and take pictures with my brain and think someday I'm going to write about this. I think that any time, you know, at least in my life, anything I do ends up sort of just going into the big pot of, like, something I might write about someday. Like, you know, with the whole thing when I said when I was on my hike, I didn't know I was going to write a book about it. Well, I also didn't not know. I was, you know, it was sort of in this place where just about everything is. Like, will I ever write about that? I mean, you and I are sitting here right now today in my living room. You know, someday, maybe I'll be 10 years from now, I'll be writing a novel.
This guy showed up in my house.
And this guy
really seem to understand his recording equipment.
This guy from Brooklyn shows up. You know what I mean? It could be fodder for something I write. And I think that that's the way a writer works all the time, which is why you never want to be friends with them. I'm joking, by the way. I won't betray you.
It's okay. Go ahead. I deserve it. My wife is a huge fan of yours.
What's your wife's name?
Her name is Meredith.
Thank you, Meredith.
This is the first time, this is a true story, it's kind of throwing Meredith under the bus, but this is the first time that I've been interviewing someone for the show, and she was like, I would like to be there, but we're in Portland, and she couldn't be here.
You should have brought her, and your baby.
She's a teacher. She had to work.
Oh, what does she teach?
She's an 8th grade special ed teacher.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
Yeah, she's an angel. She's like earning all of the karma points for our household.
And the health insurance.
She's like, yes, she's earning our karma and letting me run around and like play like this. But she and a couple of her friends are just, they're huge fans. They're really excited that I was doing this. I sent them all an email last night and it was just like, what do you want to know? What were some of your questions? And one of the questions they had that I would not have thought of about this Hollywood experience was about what it was like to be like literally physically standing next to Reese Witherspoon and all these Hollywood stars.
Yeah.
And like, you know, you've written a lot about body image.
Yes.
And about confidence and about not like playing into bullshit. Mm-hmm. And like, that is bullshit on an epic scale. That is that's like the ultimate bullshit.
It's a total bullshit. It was there again, like absolutely fascinating. Before this, you know, this red carpet season, which, you know, I say this sort of glibly, but there actually was this experience for me where,
yeah,
you know,
and you were like, I was doing it.
I was in the game. Okay. From August Wild, you know, August of 2014, Wild had its world premiere at the Telluride Film Fest. And we went to Toronto Film Fest and London Film Fest and LA premiere and Portland premiere and the Golden Globes and Oscars and also other events, other Hollywood sort of things where there was actually, you know, a red carpet with hundreds, sometimes thousands of photographers. And yes, I am to walk along this with Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern. I mean, these two like beautiful blonde movie stars. And I, you know, women who have like, you know, they live in this world, this is their work. And I am a writer and I need to stand up with them. And so from the very beginning, of course, I felt nervous and self-conscious and afraid that I wasn't going to be as pretty as them and as skinny as them and all that kind of bullshit. But what I realized at the very outset is I looked myself in the eye, I went into the bathroom, I looked at myself in the mirror, and I just said, you are going to stand up there and do this. And, you know, don't shrink at the moment when you should rise. And that is something I think that has been a value all of my life, in good times and bad too. You know, like when my mom was sick, I was really there with her. And it would have been easier to shrink. And I'm so glad I didn't. I'm so glad that I sat there with her all of that time that it was so hard to do. And that's advice I always give a sugar. It's like, be there, you know, be there even if it's hard. And, you know, I think obviously, you know, to compare like being on the red carpet with movie stars to sitting next to my mother's bedside, that seems a little bizarre. But like I was, you know, I think in that kind of sugar fashion where it's like two things can be true at once, it can be sometimes really hard to rise at the kind of most beautiful moments of our lives and or the most, in this case, the most glamorous. I decided that I was going to try to shine in a sort of Hollywood way. I was going to wear those pretty dresses and get my hair and makeup done and not feel out of place in that world. But I was also just going to be who I was and who I am and be the size that I am and have the body I have and be the 46-year-old that I am and to not allow myself to feel bad about it. So I did this thing. It was like this mind control thing that every single time I thought something negative of myself, every time I thought, you are fat and ugly and you look terrible. Every time I thought that, I said, don't think that. You're not allowed to think that. And it's amazing what that can do. Like when you actually don't let yourself be mean to yourself.
I'm actually not surprised to hear you say that, because I feel like that's a theme that runs through mm-hmm. all this stuff. Like on the trail, like yeah. I'm not going to be afraid.
Well, and what that is you're saying, there you are. I see you. I acknowledge your presence, and you will not rule me. And I think that that is so essential to any kind of success. Like, you know, I mean, we're all flawed. We're all going to fail. We're all going to be afraid sometimes. We're all going to feel terrible about ourselves sometimes, or regret, you know, what we did or said or whatnot or ate, you know. But you have to say, well, who is going to be my ruler?
Yeah.
You know, almost on a moment by moment basis, who is going to be your ruler?
But you also can't get there without some knowledge of self. Like you can't say to yourself, you're not going to do this unless you recognize what you're doing.
Right.
And that takes work too. I mean, just getting there.
It does.
Work.
It does. And I think too, you know, we like this opposition, you know, me saying like, I'm not going to let myself think you are an ugly beast. It's different than that doesn't mean I need to look at myself and think you are a beautiful goddess. Like, you know what I mean? Like the truth can be just like in the middle. Like yeah. you can just say like, here I am at the premiere of the movie about my book, about my life. And I get to sit in this auditorium with the people who made this movie and the people who came to see the movie because they're excited about it. And I just get to have this moment and let it be joyous. And I'm not going to think about what I'm looking
Fuck
like
yeah,
in my
I'm
dress.
Here.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I think so. It's so sad that we forget to have that joy sometimes, especially women, when, you know, you're always thinking like what you look like, which is just such bullshit. So I had fun with it. I got to wear lots of pretty dresses and I tried not to get too flipped out about it.
What do you think your mom would have thought?
Oh my gosh. I mean, there aren't even words. I mean, that's what's so funny is funny in a sort of sad way. My mother would be so proud of me. She'd be so happy for me. My mom's been dead so long and I have traveled so far from who I was when she died, not who I was, but where I was in the world and in my life that I don't even know that she could possibly imagine this. A big moment of truth for me is the first week that Wild was out, I got a phone call that it was from my editor saying it had debuted its first week out. It was number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list. I think of that as such a high point in this whole experience because it was the first week and it was all I wanted. Like it was all I ever dreamed. You know, it would have been fine with me if we'd had just like 1 week at number 7 and then it just like went away. I never, you know, I mean, I didn't even ever expect that. So then when that happened, it was like, holy cats, you know, this thing happened, this unbelievable thing that I never thought would happen. And the first thought I had was, I wish that I could call my mom and tell her. And the second thought I had was, I wonder if my mom knew what the New York Times bestseller list was. I don't know that she did. I didn't live in the world of the New York Times bestseller list. It was just an interesting reflection on the distance traveled.
It reminds me of a part in your book where you're talking about, you sort of, there's only one section where you sort of list out by number
yeah.
your complaints.
Against my mother.
Yeah. And one of them is that that she never pushed you to try and go to Harvard or Yale
yeah.
or a place like that because it didn't really register for her and therefore didn't really register for you that was even a possibility.
No, it really didn't. I mean, that's what's always, when you ask, like, what was it like to write Wild and to go back and remember things, really, it's really interesting for me, most of all, to remember my teenage self and my child self, myself essentially before I went to college, because I had such a different universe. Like, it never even occurred to me to even go to college out of state. Mm-hmm. I mean, that wasn't even, like, a thought in my head. When I applied to college, I applied to one college. I didn't even know you were supposed to apply to more than one. Nobody talked to me about it. And I think that sometimes that can be interpreted like that in some ways my mother wasn't being supportive or a good mother in that way. But that nothing could be further from the truth. She really didn't herself know. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You know, how could she say, well, how do we get you into a Ivy League school when like, it just wasn't in our universe. It was like, you know, going to Harvard would have been like, you know, moving to China or something. It just was not even in the realm of possibility.
So one thing I was thinking about when I was reading the book was this technology thing. I couldn't get that out of my head the whole time.
It's
just
huge.
Like, I don't know how you would do the kind of work that you were trying to do on the PCT today. Like, I do not know how you do it.
Yeah.
And another thing I kept thinking about was how different your kids' lives are going to be than yours.
Profoundly.
And how much pride and meaning you seem to take from the struggles of your childhood and being broke all the time and all the stuff that you had to both sort of like overcome, but also revel in, like all this stuff that you have built your life off of.
Yeah.
I kept thinking about how you think about that for your kids who, you know, we're sitting in like a nice house in a nice part of Portland.
Yeah.
I'm sure your kids are getting very well educated.
They go to public school, but no, I mean, they have a different life.
They'll have some options in terms of college, you know.
Before my husband and I moved into this house, this is the house that Wild bought. Mm-hmm. And before we moved in, we owned it for like 3 months before we moved in. We lived about a mile away in a duplex. So it was a two bedroom, one bath duplex that we were renting. And we bought this house. And so for the 3 months that we didn't live in it, but we owned it, we would walk past it. And both my husband grew up working class. We would like totally freak out and be like, we can't live in that house. And my husband would be like, well, we could still sell it. Like, we don't have to move in. We could sell it. And we had to talk each other into moving into this house. And it had everything to do with what you were just talking about, which is, you know, for me, the heart of it was like, well, why can't we move into this house? And I said to my husband, we remember the kids who grew up in that house in a metaphorical sense.
Yeah.
And they were the rich kids. And I really didn't like that idea. You know, and it's, and even before actually Wild success, which is kind of interesting, even before I had any money, you know, when I was, you know, with those babies and struggling and broke and all that business, even then I struggled with this question you're asking me, because, you know, of course, you know, class is not just about money. It's about culture.
Yeah.
And I made that culture hop just by getting educated. I was, even though I was sort of the impoverished elite, I had a master's degree. My husband has a master's degree. You know, we were struggling artists and didn't have any money, but we had access to the culture in ways that, you know, my mother never, like I said, she didn't even know it existed, let alone have access to it. And that disturbed me. You know, this idea that you're right on, that so much, I think, of what made me was struggle, was really understanding like the meaning of a dollar, was resilience, was learning how to get by on nothing, money not making you happy, knowing the difference between what you want and what you need, having to work really hard for everything, which I did. You know, I had a job from the time I was like 13 onward, like not just a little job, like a job, like a job where I bought all my own school clothes, mm-hmm. that kind of job, paid my way through college.
Except for the ones that your mom made for you.
Exactly. That sort of life, which absolutely informed who I am. Like, that will never leave me no matter how much money I make. You know, that's who I am at core. So then what happens is, who are my kids at core? Having me as their mother, having what's happened with Wild happen in their childhoods. They have traveled the world with me. You know, all of these places that I'm going to for the first time, they're at my side, and they're 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10, you know, and they're getting to do these amazing things.
Yeah. I read somewhere that you went on vacation with Oprah.
Yeah. We went to Oprah's house. My kids and husband and I went and spent a week with Oprah and Stedman in Maui. And we were saying to the kids, like, okay, you guys, like, this isn't normal. You're getting to have an experience that's kind of mind blowing, you know? And they're like, we know, but they don't know, which is beautiful too. Of course they don't know. They're kids. Like, this is just their lives.
Everyone, you know, hangs out with Oprah.
And, you know, they're, and obviously my husband and I, you know, are raising them with good values and, you know, all of this stuff. We do send them to our public school, and we try not to spoil them, even though they're probably totally spoiled. But, you know, they have access to opportunities and wondrous opportunities that I never got to have. And part of that is beautiful and it's going to give them something important. And part of that is going to get in the way of them learning about some of those lessons I learned about work.
Is that just like another one of those things where both things are true?
Both things are true.
Like, it's good and it's bad.
And also, you can only have the life you have. Like, how dreadful would it be that I tried to, like, you know, pretend that we were poor. Like my kids, you can't pretend with your kids, you know, that like you're not able to send them to camp. You know, the friends I have a couple of friends who grew up like upper middle class, and their parents decided to kind of give them this kind of like, you're going to learn the hard way. And so you have to pay for your own college education. So like they can't qualify for financial aid because, you know, their parents make too much money, but yet their parents won't help them with college. And I've always thought that's like really kind of like neither, like the lesson isn't delivered, because all that ends up happening is this terrible conflict between the child and the parent about the sense of withholding.
Yeah, there's also this there's this safety net element with that stuff where, right, like it's not real because it'll get paid. Like
that's right.
Like the check will always get cut. And there's a moment. There's a couple moments in Wild, that moment where you only had 2 cents.
Yeah.
Like actually 2 cents. That really struck me because in that moment, particularly because you were so alone that you kind of couldn't even get in touch with someone, it was like, you really only had 2 cents. There was not, no one was going to cover that tab. No one's going to no one's going to pay that tab.
I didn't have a credit card and I didn't have parents, and it was really that. And I think that moment in the book where you're talking about, like, and that's too where I wrote about how I realized I'd always felt this chip on my shoulder. I'd always felt sort of resentful and angry of my peers whose parents provided for them in so many ways. And there I was, and I thought, no, being poor, growing up poor, had taught me how to be in this moment right now, that I have 2 cents and I still get to do what I want to do. I still get to have my life. One of the funniest questions I get, and sometimes it's a criticism I get too, people who hate Wild will say like, you didn't even have enough money for your trip, you know? And I'll be like,
that's what people's criticism is.
Yeah. Well, they condemn me for any number of things, but one of them is that I didn't have enough money, which I always find fascinating because it's like, well, wait a minute. I did the hike, didn't I?
Yeah, it's done.
So I had enough money.
Yeah.
I didn't have as much as you think I should have had, but I had enough to do it.
Or even as much as you thought you should have had.
Exactly.
But the thing about that 2 cents thing, that 2 cents moment is at least, I mean, maybe this is my own projection, but at least reading it, that's one of the great freeing moments of the book.
It is.
You know, that's one of the, that is, you know, you were closer to yourself. There was less bullshit in that moment.
That's right.
Than there ever was. Just made me think about 2 things. One of them is Chris McCandless and Into the Wild.
Yeah.
And how much money played into his need to like get off the grid, and how like he had to actively force himself not to get bailed out. Like, mm-hmm, he had to take all these steps to create that moment for himself,
mm-hmm,
and in a way wasn't super prepared for it. But the other thing to get back to you is that like your kids are never going to have 2 cents.
Right. Well, what's interesting is like I said, you know, they don't remember. I mean, obviously when my husband and I were struggling up until just a few years ago, you know, there were all kinds of hairy situations, you know, going to Powell's bookstore here in Portland. They buy used books. My husband and I would, you know, go sell books. So we make like $20 and go buy groceries and stuff. But they were young enough that we shielded them from that. And like I said, it was like we had no money, but we had so many other things, you know. But yeah, they're not going to have that moment. And so they're going to have to learn what my struggle taught me about the world. They're going to have to learn it another way. And that's the thing, is I think you can. I think that you can learn as much from your privilege as you can from your oppression, but only if you're aware of it and only if you have consciousness. I mean, there's been so much happening, you know, like the news is so dominated lately about obviously the terrible things that have happened, like in Ferguson and Baltimore and all, you know, all, like I think we're starting to talk about racism a bit more, like it's kind of way overdue to like really talk about it. And what I've been trying to think of, like, how do I talk to my kids about it? In class too. And what I realize is it's not, I think the most important aspect to talk to kids who have privilege is to talk to them about privilege, not about racism, because of course they're like, of course we're not racist. You know, of course we think everyone's equal, but what if we say, well, what are the ways in which you are privileged? Let's talk about that. Yeah. Let's see it from that vantage point so that you do have an understanding of really the more sort of discrete ways that racism functions in the culture. And that's true with class too. I mean, do you notice that you were sent to camp?
Right.
Do you notice that you got to get your teeth fixed when you were six? And usually when you're a kid and you have those things, you didn't notice, because you thought everyone lived that way. In some ways, I thought the same thing of being poor. When I went to college, I was astonished. I was astonished that my peers had gotten things that I didn't know that one could get.
So one impact of Wild is that your kids have some privilege that they need to confront now, and you have to confront it yourself. I wonder what the impact of the book and the movie and all this has been on your brother and your sister.
My brother was a huge fan of the book when it came out. He was one of the first people to read it. He read it before it was published.
And are you guys close now?
Yeah. I mean, my brother and I, and my sister too, we have really different lives. And by which I mean, you know, they don't move in the sort of orbit that I move in. You know what I mean? And I just mean in the sort of writerly, literary, that kind of world. We have very different sort of day-to-day existences. And we've always loved each other. That never left. Like even, and I think that sometimes that got a little misinterpreted in Wild. Like it wasn't that there was a lack of love. I think that there was a lack of ability to really stay connected in a meaningful way. And I can't say that that's been entirely repaired. I mean, there's no question. We're not as close as we were when we were kids. We were close growing up. I love my brother and sister. They've been incredibly supportive of Wild, the book and the movie. My brother read it right away when I sent it to him. And we had the most meaningful exchange, I think, of our lives. You know, he said, some of those things he wrote, like I never thought that they could be written. Like I never thought that that feeling could be written. He kept saying, I can't believe you wrote all that stuff. It was really interesting to me to kind of be able to talk with my brother in a deeper, more lucid way than we'd ever been able to talk about our mother's death and the things that happened afterwards. And my sister, you know, she really is just not, she's not a reader. And so when I say, well, she didn't even read my book until it had been out like a couple of years, people, I think, maybe take that the wrong way. It is kind of funny and awkward for me, but it's just like, she didn't mean it personally. She's just not really much of a reader.
Uh-huh.
Then when she read the book, you know, she didn't say much about it, but I think she liked it. She told me she liked it. That's what she said to me about it. And that's it, you know? But I love them both. They're both good people who've had their own struggles.
Have you talked to them at all about what the impact of their daily lives has been, like being a central character in a movie that millions of people have watched?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because they have different relationships to it. My sister was not included in the film.
Right.
You know, and that was an awkward thing for me because it was like, okay, you know, I had to say to my sister, like, don't take this personally. But when they adapted the film, they didn't include the characters of my stepfather and my sister. And it was just for the reasons that go into making a movie. You have to streamline the story and condense it. And not everything in the book is in the film. And they just felt like that those characters weren't necessary to the film they were making. In the case of my brother, he is there. And, you know, for him, it's just been weird, like the funny thing that happens, you know, where it's like, oh my God, Cheryl Strayed is your sister, you know, to both of them. Friends will be like, I saw your sister in People magazine. Did you see your sister? She's on that billboard, or, you know, like these kinds of things. And so it's just kind of funny, I think, for them. And they'll send me a text saying, you know, oh, you know, I saw that picture of you and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know?
What was it like to see your story edited and streamlined in that way? Like, you sound like you're kind of at peace with it. I feel like for some people, it's a really like painful process.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like, this isn't true to my tale, but how was it for you?
Yeah, it was a great experience from the beginning. And I think that that was the important piece is, you know, I optioned the book to Reese Witherspoon and her producing partner, Bruno Papandrea, when they founded their own production company, Pacific Standard, with the goal of, you know, finding strong roles for women, stories that feature strong women. They were sort of tired of what they were seeing in Hollywood. And I think because Reese obviously stars in the film, people assumed that this was like a big Hollywood production. But actually, Wild is an indie film made for what's considered quite a low budget in Hollywood. And what that meant is we had more creative control. And I think that was really important to Reese. She, from the very beginning, our first conversation when I first was considering, you know, letting her option, it was like, I asked her, well, what is your vision? Why do you want to tell this story? And it was because she really identified with me. She identified with the story I was telling in that same way. We were just talking about that kind of universal connection of building that bridge between my life and your life. Reese felt that. And she wanted to have that story, have all of its complexity and humanity. She wanted the story to end on the bridge with the woman who has 20 cents and no job and no home and no man and all that stuff, and that she's totally okay. She wanted to tell that story. And so every choice they made all along the way was in service to that. Mm-hmm. When we talk about like my Hollywood experience, I actually had a not so Hollywood experience, because always it was creativity that was honored. It wasn't what's going to make this story the most palatable to the masses. It was, what is the meaning of the story? Nick Hornby, who wrote the script, had that vision. Jean-Marc Vallée, who directed it, had that vision. Reese Witherspoon and Laura Dern and all of the people who were in the movie had that vision, and they saw it out.
Did it feel like you? Did it feel like a version of you?
Well, that's it. Watching the movie is so interesting to me because it goes in and out of feeling like me. Absolutely, it feels like a version of me. Now, some scenes are right for my life, and they're so real that it takes my breath away. Like every time I see it, I'll just, you know.
I mean, it. I assume that this is probably not right, but it feels like it must feel like almost like a dream.
It does. It's so surreal. It really, I mean, I keep saying that real. It's actually what surreality is. It feels like an altered reality. Because there's reality and then it's just an alteration of it, right? But then other scenes are like, no, that never happened. Like, I never did have sex with two guys in an alley. So when I see that scene, I'm like, nah, you know? And like I would have changed that scene. I would have changed that piece of the movie. But I also understood what Jean-Marc needed to do. You know, in film language, he needed to communicate really quickly about this kind of destructive promiscuity. And so I wasn't going to impose myself there, you know? I go in and out of really feeling like it's me, but mostly it does feel like me. And Reese, all my friends were like, man, you know, Reese really bore a striking resemblance to me, especially me at 26. It was really, really fascinating the way she portrayed me.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Like, I watched the movie this morning. I hadn't seen it until this morning.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I watched it this morning because I wanted to, like, I really, really didn't want it to color.
Right.
Like, I reread Wild. I reread all this Dear Sugar stuff. I really didn't want it to feel like it was like Reese Witherspoon in the movie, you know? But I got to say, like, even now, it's like you're like 90% you, the person who's sitting in front of me, and also like 10% Reese Witherspoon.
That's not bad. That's good. I like that percentage. Yeah. Reese is pretty awesome. We all became like family.
I want to talk a little bit about fear and fear as it relates to writing. Very constant theme on this show is people talking about the anxiety of their next story and their next piece and where that's going to come from. And I think one of the like things that we hear over and over again that people find value in these conversations is hearing that these people who have kind of reached great heights in this profession still feel that anxiety, and that anxiety is relatively universal. But the kind of writing that you do, particularly I'm thinking about all of it, I guess. And I don't think this is just about memoir, because it is about those stories that you tell in Dear Sugar. You're putting yourself out there. There are ugly parts of yourself there. But even more than that, like getting to our subterranean river is some scary shit. It is scary to write that way, to try and get there, because in part you might not do it. You might end up in like the mushy self-help section of the bookstore. And I'm interested in just how you get over that. How do you top that fear? How do you take your first step, whatever cliche I could throw at you? Like,
I always remember that the best things come from fear. I mean, when you visit the subterranean river, the stakes are high. And why bother writing anything in which the stakes are not high, right? You know, I mean, I think that the writing that matters the most to me and to you and to all the readers in the world is this writing that tells us who we are and risks that profound, deep vulnerability. And so I really keep faith with that. You know, I really remember that the best things that have come from me have risen from me being the most terrified, the most fearful of rejection. When I say the stakes are high, what I mean is, you know, if you deliver this manuscript and it's rejected, what they have rejected is your heart. And if you haven't handed that over, you haven't handed it over. Like, I really don't think I've done my work unless I've basically handed somebody my heart. You know, all three of my books, that's what I felt like I was handing to the editor, to my agent, and to the world when it gets published. You know, sometimes I think that when we talk about emotions and we use words like the heart, you know, we think we're talking about the sappy shit. We're not talking about sappy shit. I'm talking about great rigor when it comes to craft and intellect and thinking things all the way through and mastering the form and all of that kind of stuff. But I am also talking about deep vulnerability. And so it's scary. You know, it's also really, you know, before I wrote Wild, the scary part was what will probably happen is I'll hand the world my heart and nobody's going to give a shit. Okay, that's usually what happens, right? It's usually what happens with art. That's the history of the arts, okay? It's just the fact of it. Like, when I teach classes, I'm like, you know, the poor students, like, look at me, like, with such horror, because right. I say, listen, if you manage to be lucky enough to be one of those people who actually manages to finish a book, which, by the way, is only going to be, like, you know, only a few of you in this room, probably it won't be published. And probably, if it is published, not many people will read it. And probably, like, I just go on and on and on, and they're like horrified. And I don't mean it to be discouraging. I mean, like, I actually feel fortunate that I embraced that truth before the crazy ass shit that happened with Wild happened.
Cause then it like felt like crazy ass shit and not like it was like owed.
Exactly. Well, like every day of my life since the crazy ass shit happened with Wild, I'm like, I am fully aware this is crazy ass shit. Now, this doesn't mean that I don't think I worked my fucking hiney off to have that success. I did. I actually worked my ass off. I also know it would be true that I worked my ass off if, like, nobody read Wild.
The crazy ass shit wasn't guaranteed.
That's right. The hard work is what's true. The crazy ass shit is, like, the lucky, crazy ass, you know, since that's going to be our phrase. It's just the luck of life, the great fortune of life. Now, that's what I'm trying to make a distinction here is between, I mean, I think there's a long history of women especially saying, well, you know, I just got lucky. I didn't just get lucky. I worked my fucking ass off and then I got lucky. And if I hadn't worked my ass off, I wouldn't have gotten lucky. So you have to do the work. You always have to do the work. And part of the work is about getting comfortable, being uncomfortable, learning how to say, hello, fear, thank you for being here, because you are my indication that I'm doing what I need to do.
In your experience, is that something you have to learn once or something that you learn multiple times?
Every day, all the time. I mean, that's the thing. That never changes for me. Like, writing has never gotten easier. There are things that I know now that I didn't know before.
Like what?
Well, like, trust your intuition. Yeah. Like, if you know, the way it feels to write a book is that you can't write a book, you know? I mean, I remember with Wild just being like in the middle of it and just like, you know, I can't do this. Like, I actually cannot do this. I'm writing this book and it's a failure and it's a mess. And there's no way on this green earth that I will ever finish it. And I remembered that I felt that way when I was writing Torch. If you took my journals, like when I die and some, you know, so my kids read my journals, what they're going to find is one of the funniest things for me is if you just read my journals during the years that I was writing Torch and you didn't know that Torch had been published, you would think that I had failed to write my novel, because the whole journal is me lamenting about how I can't write and what a failure I am. And, you know, all of this negative stuff about how I can't do it and I'm not doing it and I tried to do it, but it sucks. And I did it, but it's not working, you know, all of that. That's the narrative. And then meanwhile, what I was doing is writing my book. So then with Wild, I was like, oh, this is how it feels to write a book. I'm writing a book because I feel like a failure. So here we go again, gang. And, you know, now working on, I mean, I have this quotes book coming out, obviously, but then when I say my next book, I mean like the next book that I'm, you know, actually writing.
Right, not copying and pasting.
Not copying. But I mean, you know, my next book, it's like, I can't do it. And now there's another reason that I can't do it, which is now I do have an audience.
Yeah.
And now people actually are waiting for the book. It's not that the world doesn't give a shit. The world is like, where's your next book?
Yeah.
Which also has its own like mind fuck tyranny. Because
I'm sure.
It's like, and I've said, I'm like, you're probably not going to like it. It's probably not going to please you. It's probably not going to hit all the bells that Wilde hit sort of culturally, you know? I mean, for whatever reason, Wilde just rang a lot of those bells at this moment in time.
You think this is about a moment in time? Because before we were talking about like how it had the three pillars of the ancients.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also think what I mean by that is it's connected to that crazy ass thing. Like, I think a lot of books hit the notes of the ancients, and then for whatever reason, like 20 people read it. Right.
There is some. I was talking to a friend of mine this morning. He told me I've never read it, but there's another book about by a guy who walked the PCT.
There are several books.
Yeah.
I mean, I think people don't know that Wilde is just one of many books about people hiking the PCT.
It's just the one that the crazy ass shit happened to happen for.
Yeah, but that too, again, it's Wilde is probably the most literary book.
Yeah, I don't mean to like get into like a qualitative.
Yeah, it's like you never, what I mean, like, so let's tear this, let's break this down. I think it's important because it's like, what I mean is I do think that when a book does like what Wilde did, it's hitting that universal note. It's, you know, a writer who did his or her work. It's also like, who knows? Like, right?
Yeah.
What is the convergence? Why are we ready to hear this story right now?
Do you have a theory?
I don't. But I do think that sometimes plays into it, uh-huh. Right? 20 years ago, would we have been ready to hear a story about a woman hiking the trail? I don't know. I mean, I don't think we can know that.
I hadn't thought about that. Like what that moment was.
I'm wrong. Maybe it's not.
I am sure you're right that there is something about the moment that we're in right now where a story that can end with a woman broke on a bridge with no man.
Right.
And feeling okay resonates.
It's like the anti-fairy tale. Maybe part of its connection was about that.
I also think, I mean, at least for me, I think the technology stuff is real too. It was so recent that all of the cultural touchstones people reading the book remember. All the songs you're singing are songs that people know. You're going to REI.
Yeah.
Like it's present in that way. And yet, to me, it feels completely inaccessible. The idea that you could go off the map like that.
No, see, and this is what I'm talking about. When I say that I think that part of its popularity has to do with the moment.
There's an escape fantasy element to it.
And I'm writing about like the kind of the last moment, or almost the last moment in America that we weren't all walking around, you know, checking our email with cell phones in our back pockets, right? Like it really, I mean, it took a little bit longer for cell phones to become part of life, but pretty quickly, you know, by the late 90s, a lot of people were on the internet, right? Mm-hmm. In 1995, they were not. I remember being on the trail, meeting another hiker, and she and I were sort of exchanging addresses, and she said, "Do you have email?" And I was like, "What's that?" I said, I've heard of email, but I don't understand what it is. Mm-hmm. And she's like, "Well, you're at your computer, and then you get like letters on your computer." Right. And I was like, this idea seemed preposterous to me. And it's funny to think of that, because this was, like you said, it was only 1995. We remember the songs that were popular then. And yet it was this other world, because we weren't all connected to each other.
That's like it's connected to the 2 cent lack of a safety net, right?
Yeah.
Is like, if you did that now, even if you were like, I need this time to myself, this is about being alone, I'm gonna be cut off, the thing you would say is like, I'm gonna leave my phone off the whole time.
Yeah.
That would be a crazy thing to do at this point, would be to not take a phone, because at any point, like that moment, whatever, like when you're in the desert with no water, you might be like, I'm gonna call somebody and get some water out here, because I'm like,
right,
might die now.
But that idea that the technology, at least when it comes to venturing into the wilderness, makes us safer, I don't buy it. First of all, was it like there were droves of people dying in the wilderness, and then the cell phone was invented, and now like nothing bad is happening? No, it wasn't that way. You know, I think that very little has changed when it comes to how dangerous the wilderness is. If anything, I think having technology out there with us, it makes us like take more risks. You think, well, if I do run out of water, I can always call somebody.
Yeah.
And I just feel like it really, all the technology does in the wilderness is rob us of the opportunity to have what humans have had throughout all time until like the last, 15 or 20 years.
That's the part I'm talking about.
Which is solitude, which is actual solitude. Do you know, what are you, 33, did you say?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you, and maybe you're old enough to remember this. I'm really curious, in your life, your experience. Have you ever been out in the wilderness and nobody knows really exactly where you are? And if you needed to communicate with somebody, it would be at least a day before you could communicate with them. Have you ever been that alone?
Well, that's a good question. I have been in like countries alone where no one knew where I was, but there was like an internet cafe somewhere probably.
Right. If you could in an hour or two.
Yeah. I always had the ability to like, I'm talking about like 2000, like right. 99.
Mm-hmm.
I had a safety net.
But even that little bit where like nobody knows exactly where I am.
Yeah.
Wasn't that kind of liberating?
Yeah. And it was over so quickly.
Yeah.
It was over so, so quickly. I mean, I feel the same way about like I graduated from college in 2003. So like the internet was very present, but like I went to the library to use the internet,
Sure.
Like I would check my email once a day and then like go about your life. And I feel like the freshmen when I was a senior all showed up with cell phones.
Yeah.
And like no one I knew had a cell phone. It was like that. It was that close.
Yeah. No, it changed. I mean, even just in this time we've been talking, the hour or so or 2 hours now, I think, we haven't checked our email, but I'm a little bit conscious of that. Aren't you? Like,
oh, definitely.
People have emailed us and I can feel them stacking up.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk for a long time about my like anxieties around like buzzing and messages and all that bullshit. And like, but there's something different about, I just did like to cap that idea. I just think it's like, if you're looking for what that thing about this moment was that connected with that book, at least for me, it was, I cannot wrap my head around how I'd do it.
Right. Oh, and it's like a nostalgia for what we've lost.
Yeah.
The real solitude, solitude. One of my favorite books about the wilderness, probably my favorite book about the wilderness, Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey. Have you ever read it?
Mm.
Oh, it's so good. I read it when I was like 19 or 20, and then I just read it again last year. And it's this incredible book. And he writes about being alone and not being connected. And like the way that you interact with people is they are in your company. They are present with you. And that's it. Like that's the way you communicate with people. And we are losing something. I mean, and I love technology. Don't get me wrong. I have, all of those connections and communications, and I totally treasure them and value them. I am not by any stretch condemning technology, but I do think, why can't we say no to ourselves ever? Like, why can't we just mostly agree that when we go onto hiking trails or on the wild rivers or rock climbing or whatnot, that we do not have our cell phones with us? Our internet connections. Like, what if we as a society agreed that it was like a faux pas? It's like pulling it out of the opera, but people pull it out of the opera too.
Yeah, I do think we're headed, like, I do think it's going to become a faux pas. Like, I think it's going to be bad manners to use your phone. I think people are going to like use your phone like you use the bathroom. But at the same time, people are going to be wearing their phones and like their fingernail.
Right.
And you're not even going to know when they're checking their phone.
Is that what you think?
Yeah.
Ugh.
I think
I have despair about this because I'm really a huge,
clearly,
huge part of my experience was about real solitude, like solitude period. Like no question.
One of the ways that I look at the world is people's self-knowledge, their happiness, their, whatever that thing is that, means you're comfortable with yourself in the world.
The inner jelly core feels okay.
The inner jelly core is a way better way than I've ever put that. That your inner jelly core has a lot to do between the gap between the way you live your life and the values you espouse, who you say you are and who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
For a memoirist, for someone who has made a name for herself writing about her own subterranean river.
Right.
Well, you just mix up all the metaphors. There's this third thing, right?
The intergelly core, there's a little canal that leads right. to the subterranean river.
If you step on the intergelly core in the subterranean river, your foot will sink in, but not all the way to the bottom. It like floats a little bit. Here's what I'm asking about, right? There's like a gap between who the way you live your life and the values you espouse. And then there's this third person. There's this third Cheryl Strayed, which is the writer and the person you put out. And I'm interested in how close those three things are.
Right. Well, the gap between the way I live my life and the values I espouse, that question, I think it's pretty narrow. I mean, I think it's about as wide as like most people with good intentions. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, do I, as I said earlier, you know, do I fail sometimes? Do I wish that I'd done this thing instead of that thing sometimes? Do I feel like sorry or regretful or like, why the hell did you do that? Sometimes, absolutely. But not in any kind of extreme, severe way.
I think the thing I was asking was, how close is the Cheryl Strayed in your writing to who you are?
Well, you've been sitting here talking to me for 2 hours. What do you think? Do I seem like you thought I would be?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think that the person I am on the page is pretty close to who I am in real life.
How do you get there?
Well, see, that's always the most fascinating question to me, because to me, it would be the other place that would be harder to go. Like, how do I get there? I didn't try to get there. You know, when I'm writing the best, I'm not pretending to be somebody else. Like, one of the most interesting experiences of my life as a writer was that with my first book, Torch, they didn't make an audiobook of it until after Wild was a success. And so they asked me to read the audiobook. And so I had not read Torch, my first book, for like maybe 5 or 6 years since I had published it. And then there I was in the studio reading it out loud. And what was fascinating to me about this book, which I, you know, put my whole heart into and tried so hard and did my best, when you read your book out loud, you really have to inhabit every word. You have to say every word and feel every word and know what it means and how it should be said. So I got deep into that story again. And I could go line by line and paragraph by paragraph and page by page, and I could point to where I was trying to be Raymond Carver, and where I was trying to be Mary Gateskill, and where I was trying to be Toni Morrison, and Alice Munro, and Richard Ford, and on and on and on. And this isn't to say that I plagiarized them. I didn't. But I respected them and admired them, and I was trying to learn from them. And so I was trying to be them. I was trying to find my voice by imitating theirs in some regard. And in Wild, even though those influences are there in the water, you know, of that, they're in my subterranean river as a writer. They're the sort of water that I rise out of. I couldn't point to them on the page. There's not one sentence in Wild that I would say, well, there's my Mary Gateskill sentence. Every sentence in Wild is a Cheryl Strayed sentence. And of course, it's born of all of these influences and all of these things. But what happened is I relaxed. I was trying really hard to be impressive in Torch, and the way to be impressive then for me was to be Richard Ford or Alice Munro or whoever. And then by Wild, I sort of let my defenses down, and I realized the only person I can be is me in real life and on the page. And so I'm going to try to really like get out of my way and you know, create a persona that is like the truest expression of my own voice and everything I've learned and everything I've read and everything I wanted to be, and let that sit there on the page and be what it is, whether it's impressive or not. And so I think that that's the best answer I can give you about that kind of like, am I really that person? It's like, that's all I can be. The work I had to do to get there was to learn how to write. And the work I would have to do to try to be somebody else on the page than who I really am would be so much harder. I mean, it would be like moving backwards, you know?
Must be incredibly validating to find your voice and then have it be followed by the crazy ass shit.
Oh my God, are you kidding me? It's the glory of life. It has been the coolest thing, and I'm so grateful for it. I mean, it's just a really amazing thing that's happened. I never forget how grateful I am for that.
I'm grateful for you taking all this time.
Oh, thank you.
Cheryl, thank you so much.
It was really fun talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Long Form. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Thank you, Jenna, for the overtime this week. And thanks also to our sponsors, HP Matter, Squarespace, and Tiny Letter. But most of all, thank you to Cheryl Strayed for spending her Monday afternoon talking to me. We'll see you next week. Running.